Hello, everyone. You are listening to Supriya and her friend Deepanjana on The Lit Pickers, a podcast about books and reading from the city of Bombay. Though I want to start here with an admission of failure as far as the reading bit is concerned, because, you know, Deepanjana, when we met a couple of weeks ago, the TV show Shogun had just started airing and we were talking about it and we liked the direction that it was taking. And you said that you had read the Shogun book by James Clavell when you were a kid, which was in the 19th century, as longtime listeners of The Lit Pickers know.
Yeah, as an ancient crone of another era, I can report that James Clavell? I can't remember.
James Clavicle.
Sorry,
we have so much trouble with white people's names. I'm so sorry.
They'll just survive given what they've done to my name over the years. Anyway, Shogun used to be on many people's bookshelves and, you know, the bedside table. It's a big fat doorstopper
of a
book.
Kind of like a dad book, right?
It was a book
that dads like to read.
Yeah.
So Charged, I went back to try and attempt to read it. And I have to say, I got through 30 pages and it was one of the more spectacular reading failures I've had in recent times.
I need to preface this by saying I also warned you that it is a terrible book to read now because we have grown up, as has literature. And maybe back in the day, it definitely had the exotic appeal of the 70s. The book is very much about the white savior complex. It's bringing Japan to the light. It's full of cliches. It's full of romanticizing. It's full of exoticizing. And all of this seemed acceptable when we were growing up. Like, white writers wrote about the East in this way. They had been doing so for about 200 years.
Yeah. And we've talked about this in an earlier episode we recorded on Japanese literature, which we poetically called J-Lit or J-Lit. The J-Lit Pickers right here,
that
so much of what we read growing up about Japan,
yes,
sorry to mess up timelines here, we are talking about the 20th century, in fact, came refracted through the prism of American obsession with Japan, which was, of course, a product of military occupation and creepy Japanophilia. And
kind of a neo-imperialism, I would say.
And neo-imperialism. So this got me thinking about the allure of adaptation and how we are perhaps in an era, you know, I don't want to give this a lot of credit because, as I hope we can unpack, you know, through our conversations with this episode, I also feel like there's something alarming about the age of intellectual property that we're living in. Mm. You know, the film critic Richard Brody never uses the initials IP. Mm. He always writes it like I as in EYE and P as in PEE. But the possibilities that are now opened up to us thanks to an overcapitalized streaming industry are perhaps worth talking about.
Also because this instinct to capitalize on existing products, which is what these books and stories are seen as, and then there's the resource, which is the fandom or the popularity that surrounds it. Mm-hmm. The instinct to capitalize on these two things is weirdly counterbalanced, I think, by an intellectual campaign that has been running very strongly, particularly, I would say, since the 60s, which is to highlight what is going on as subtext, to highlight context, to highlight politics, the need to have better representation. These are all part of an intellectual campaign that has been running from academia into public discourse. And really, like, it's one of those sad things, right? Like, stuff like big tech, evil, horrible, all of that, but it's made ideas like post-colonialism, feminism, everyday conversations have these thoughts in them because of big tech in a way that was harder to do before.
Mm. Now, postmodernism meets late capitalism.
Yeah, too many isms coming here, but
it's,
you know.
It's true.
But the bottom line.
And as I remember a critic once saying, late capitalism sounds very optimistic, which may be a joke that I've repeated on the Lit Pickers before.
No, I don't think you have. It's a good point. It's far from late. It's very much current. What's happened in recent adaptations is that they are not faithful to the books in many ways, while being faithful to the ideas in the books, but also cherry-picking the ideas. And Shogun is a great example.
Yeah, I know you really liked the show. And because you read the novel early, you had like kind of a strong sense of the themes of the book.
So I read Shogun as a teenager.
Right.
I was curious about places like Japan, which
absolutely.
I had not seen.
Pico Iyer's entire influence on my life as a teenager comes from
going to Bolivia and Japan and, you know, to places that I could not even imagine myself going to at that point of time. So I read it out of curiosity. But even as a teenager, there were bits of it which were a bit like, really? Is that what? Never mind. Now, watching the show, the first thing that the show does is that instead of having Blackthorn, the white savior of the book, at the center, it has Toranaga, played by Hiro Sanada. Just so fabulous. But the moment you shift that center to be a Japanese character rather than the outsider, everything about the show and the storytelling becomes better.
Yeah. Okay, very quickly, Shogun, for those of you who landed on this planet yesterday, first of all, hi, welcome. Second of all, it's a kind of fictionalization of the end of the Sengoku period in Japan, where I suppose the closest famous parallel in Western history is the end of the Republic and the rise of Caesar in Rome. So a bunch of real people who are the protagonists of that internecine conflict become fictionalized. So
yeah.
Tokugawa, who establishes the shogunate, becomes Toranaga in Shogun.
In Shogun.
And he did, I think, in history, have miraculously a white English pilot
yes, he did.
To aid him at crucial moments.
Yeah.
And of course, James Clavell, who picked up on this historical footnote, embroidered
exactly.
on it, and made this white pilot the center of kind of all change that affected yeah. Japan.
It is in this historic period, as you said, but it's essentially tapping into a 1970s fixation for what was seen as a very closed society,
right.
Japan.
Yeah.
Right?
Being so, penetrated by white men.
Being literally.
You know the David Mitchell novel, which a
Cloud
lot of people
Atlas.
Like? And no, there's oh. a lot of people like, and maybe you like it too, so the, you know, no judgment, because it is a very fine achievement, like all of David
Thousand
Mitchell's
Autumns?
Work is. Yeah. The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zuid, which is about a Dutchman
yes.
entering Japan
yes.
and taking her.
Yeah.
And the penile fixation in
yes.
parts of that novel. I mean, David Mitchell is too smart to make it.
Yeah, he's
very
not literal.
Obvious.
Clavicle is.
from clavicle to
father
genital.
Down. Yeah.
Paging Dr. Freud. My apologies to everyone whose last name is Clavel. It's kind of laughably evident. I also feel like the obsession with this period in the West, you know, has so much to do with Westerners really loving it when military dictatorships come to Asia.
To save them.
It's their favorite
from themselves.
Thing to happen. Yeah, that's right. All of these
yeah.
major actors in Shogun have played versions of these characters,
yeah.
versions of the historical characters in like Chidaigeki, right?
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is
yeah.
What, the
it's
Japanese version of the saga.
Yeah, the historical epic.
The period drama.
The period
I believe
drama.
It's called by Westerners.
Yeah. What period, why drama, whatever. Yeah, no, it's a fabulous adaptation. And
I'm so happy to hear that. I've seen the first couple of episodes.
Yeah,
and
no,
cool.
I really, really liked it. And I loved it because, see, if you're being... And I think we should be, by the way, generous to Clavel and his idea of writing Shogun, because we are all writing within what we think are acceptable ideas in our time.
Absolutely.
Right?
And look, the guy was right. Even as a purely commercial proposition, it made sense to center the white man as your protagonist.
I don't think...
Probably had a cool story to begin with. So Clavel was right about that.
Absolutely.
And until you told me before we entered the recording studio, I thought that the upcoming Netflix adaptation of The Three-Body Problem had replaced many of the Chinese characters with white characters
yeah.
because that's what the trailer led me to believe.
Not the case. it's trying for a more multicultural Three-Body Problem. From what I've seen, I haven't finished the entire show. It is not as Chinese as the book, but I
Or as Chinese as the Chinese adaptation.
Shocking.
Which turned up 2 years ago, I think.
Which you have not seen
I
either.
Haven't seen.
Yeah.
I've read the books,
yeah.
which I liked and which I thought were... You know, I mean, Liu Cixin is an old-fashioned guy himself. And part of the appeal of those books, I think, is that they feel like they belong to an older era of science fiction. Except, of course, for what it's worth, they're engaging with Chinese politics. They are about Maoist China very substantially, and a critique of how that period scarred and changed society forever.
And see, this is where contemporary contexts make such a difference. In today's world and today's America, putting on Netflix a show that critiques Maoist China is very, very politically acceptable. It would not have been a few years ago. The idea that we are critical of a certain kind of China is very sexy right now. Because,
right. And to be fair, it doesn't really hurt the Chinese powers that be either, right?
No,
like Xi Jinping had to live in a cave during the Cultural Revolution. So
it's something that works today.
He's open to some criticism. Although I should say that I think Xi Jinping himself says that that time built his character.
Aww.
So, you know, there are critiques and then there are critiques.
Yeah. I like how characters like Lego or Jenga just getting built and falling apart, built and falling apart. Lovely. Anyway, I think it's a show that is trying to be responsive to the present, which is what most of these books are, you know, whether they're set in the past or they're imagining futures, writers are responding to their present. And when it gets adapted to another medium in another time, you get to play on these ideas responding in a new way to the present day world. And that's very exciting when it's done well. We have finally understood that to make a good adaptation from book to show or film, you have to figure out the idea rather than be fixated on details. And for me, the first adaptation that really did that well is Lord of the Rings. Not, I have to clarify, because Amazon has gone ahead and done a Lord of the Rings series, which is regrettable at every possible level.
I think
I'm
you can listen
about
to
the
our
movies.
Yes, I think you can listen to our cousins at the podcast
Nerditorium. Our twins, I believe.
They are us.
They're us.
I'm told. Discuss this down to brass tacks in far more detail. But see, this is where I think the question of IP and adaptation comes in, which is that the Rings of Power, the Amazon show, is the way it is because of the limited IP that they had access to. And because I think their approach to this story entirely was obsessed with gaining control, gaining mastery, gaining dominance over some part of Tolkien's legacy in a way that I find really charmless. Though I should say that I heard just this morning before recording that the young woman who plays Galadriel on that show has just started fundraising to get Palestinians out of Rafah. So, which
That's
is a very
fantastic.
Galadriel thing to do.
And she was perhaps one of the less awful parts of the show. But
also, Peter Jackson worked, right? Because it was a kind of filmmaking first approach to The Lord of the Rings.
Also, while I do agree with you about the limited IP situation, the problem with Rings of Power was limited imagination. It drew entirely on the aesthetics and the visuals and the textures that Peter Jackson set up in his movies. Peter Jackson and his fabulous team. Because really, and that's something that Jackson has emphasized in interview after interview, that it's not just him. There's an amazing team of people who are putting together and recreating this world, whether it's Rivendell or the Orcs or, you know, every granular detail of those three movies, not so much the Hobbit set, but the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, was elaborately worked on as a hive mind. Mm. And it created something extraordinary. Extraordinary, not just because it was so steeped in fandom. You know, these were all people who read the books, who went to the artists, various artists, and like, how did you think of this? What did you think of that? The geekiness of it was glorious, but also, like you just said, it was imagined as cinema. So it meant departing from the books in many ways. It meant losing stuff. It meant compressing stuff.
It meant making some things two-dimensional.
Yes.
But I do remember as a young fan watching these movies in the theaters with other young fans. And I think I'll always remember one of my friends saying, almost as if he was talking about another fan. He's like, yeah, you know, his imagination outstripped mine in some of those scenes. And I realized that that was the tremendous value that Peter Jackson brought to people who loved the books. And perhaps, again, the great value was also the idea that while this was a trilogy for the world, it was primarily made by fans for fans. And I think there's a real power to that.
Yeah.
If you are doing something like The Rings of Power, which is essentially made on the whims of one fan who is Jeff Bezos, that's when maybe, you know, trying to create something new and fresh out of it requires fresh out-of-the-box thinking, which they did do in some areas, like casting, but where I suppose, you know, imagination kind of didn't go far enough.
Yeah, like,
do you feel like this was not a problem with Dune, another set of movies and books I have nothing to do with? Although, to borrow from someone else very funny on Twitter, they said, you know, I have read the Quran, so I had all the spoilers.
Yeah, the Quran informs, I think, a lot of what Herbert imagined of Arrakis. Mm. Dune is actually a set of 21 books, of which only 6 Herbert wrote. Mm.
And the others were produced by a syndicate like the Hardy Boys, the Mardy Boys.
Herbert's boy, as it turns out.
And I see.
And I think his editor, someone, I forget now. I have not read all 21. I've only read the first one, okay? First of all, it's so overwhelmingly male in the most boring sense that this is a problem that I've had with a lot of science fiction when I was trying to read it as a younger person.
Absolutely.
It was just all about boys and men.
And
boys.
By the way, some guys can't escape that even when the protagonists are women, like the three-body problem books. I just want
you
to know.
Yes. So Herbert's imagining of Arrakis and the space opera is on one hand very, very compelling in certain ways. But I was very, very amused when I saw the film because for better or for worse, and I have read people who have Palestinian heritage, Algerian heritage, Moroccan heritage, who have read Dune and really enjoyed it because there's so much of their beliefs and culture just folded into the Fremen world.
So the Fremen are North Africans?
Kind of, yes.
Okay.
So Dune imagines a world in which there is a resource called spice, which is
oil,
which is not oil, like the oil, but it is actually like a drug. Everyone's like loopy and on a high in Dune. You got to remember this, right? This is written in the 60s. It's an acid trip in a book,
right,
essentially. So yes, spice is an equivalent of oil, but if oil was also giving you like a trip. And this is
some people do sniff petrol. You
this
know?
Is true.
Yeah, as you're speaking, I realized that we had to wait for this moment for a film adaptation of Dune to really hit, because finally we've moved from the age of acid and there was a long stretch of maybe, I mean, sure, there were other drugs in between, but we've perhaps finally entered the age of MDMA. and so people are ready to receive this.
Those still suits are just taking on a whole new meaning now. The control of this resource is very central to some of the conflicts, but essentially Dune is the story of an anti-hero. Paul Atreides begins as someone who is really not supposed to be brought into the world the way he has, but gets seeded as a messiah and then turns out to be something far darker. It's the story of an anti-hero, like I said, not a hero's journey, but an anti-hero's journey.
Right. A classic story for a big blockbuster film.
Classic story for someone as baby-faced as Timothée Chalamet to do. You know, it's going against type, I guess. What I found very interesting about the film adaptation was that it whitewashed the whole thing. So despite holding on to the idea of Arrakis being this desert landscape, there are barely any people of color, and all the people of color in the first movie, at least, are killed. They're just minor characters who die. White people are the only people who survive. Javier Bardem is passing off as a Fremen, which is hilarious.
Right.
Chani,
proving that nothing has, in fact, changed from 1962 when Indians, including I.S. Johar and white people in dark makeup, made up a large part of the cast in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm so sad to hear that the West still hasn't found a way to get so Arab actors to play Arabs.
Aside from Zendaya, nobody else that I can remember off the top of my head has a key role in Dune and is a person of color. They're all white.
Wasn't Oscar Isaac in one of the films?
He died also.
Well, you know, there's a reason the name isn't Atreides. Because the white guy's got to survive.
But, you know, what's interesting is that as beautiful as the Dune films are, and they are stunningly beautiful.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
The books, in their own way, did make more space for different kinds of Arab culture in the way the Fremens were written. The only thing is that while it was set up that way, there's also a very, very troubling dynamic set up where Paul Atreides can essentially lead what is a herd of unthinking, almost infantile people into what Herbert wrote as a jihad.
That's pretty Lawrence of Arabia.
It is very Lawrence
of
Arabia. However,
I mean, it's a little more complex in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes, because the local population are not just a herd. Lawrence identifies with them. He doesn't only lead them.
And it's very clear, I think, both in Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is actually quite a racist tract, and Lawrence of Arabia, which has a far more complex view of the history that it is commenting on, that there's a great deal of self-interest and political awareness among the Arabs that Lawrence is trying to corral.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, they're locked in this battle of competing interests.
Yeah.
And that's what really frustrates and, you know, kind of shatters Lawrence, despite his boyish crush on Bedouin culture.
Yeah, this romanticized idea that he has of Bedouin culture. What I found very insightful in Villeneuve, Denis Villeneuve, who's the director of the Dune films and has also adapted the script.
Right. And also adapted Ted Chiang's Story of My Life into Arrival.
Flattened the crap out of that one, as beautiful as that film was. But anyway, in this one, it was interesting to me that in the Fremen society, he actually does show different factions, which I don't remember in Dune. So there are the Northern Fremen and the Southern Fremen who are different in terms of how they see the Messiah and what they imagine the Messiah to be. So Javier Bardem's gang are the more easily convinced, whereas Chani's gang are the slightly disbeliever sort. So he did, in his adaptation, try to give the Fremen a little more character and dynamism, particularly through Chani's character. Chani's character is radically changed by Villeneuve. Like, she has so much more to do, and it's wonderful to see. Another character that he has built up out of almost nothing is Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson, Paul's mother. She's in the book a second-class consort who's, like, kind of barely accorded any sort of status or importance. Jessica is a big deal right now, and she's powerful. She's key to a lot of Paul's powers, and as well as the storytelling. So Villeneuve's adaptation does a lot of service to the original books.
So she's like the Volumnia to his Coriolanus.
Yeah, yeah. So
I see.
Like,
that's
really
cool.
Really builds it up better. Again, these are changes that have, I think, worked well cinematically as well. That freedom to change things around is key, I think, to making an adaptation work. Something that works in the books, irrespective of whether I like Herbert's writing or not, the fact is that these are incredibly compelling worlds that he set up, described beautifully. There's craziness in terms of the ideas that he's embedded into it.
There's a way in which I think cinema and maybe even TV can compress those ideas without flattening them, although more often than not when we're talking about like quick and dirty IP, this is exactly what we end up talking about, which is a, you know, us going back to an age old, the movie is not as good as the book.
Except now I think that's changing for me at least, because for example, there are two things that come to mind, neither of which are quick and dirty, to be fair. One of them I would love to be quick and dirty. But anyway, I'm talking about Lupin. Arsène Lupin, Gentleman Thief, written by Maurice Leblanc. Very white, very posh, Gentleman Thief. That gets adapted to Lupin, the Netflix series starring Omar Sy as a guy who is the son of a Senegalese immigrant and a gentleman thief, but not a gentleman in the sense of an aristocracy by a long shot. And Omar Sy is just sparklingly brilliant.
And I think that change, the change of race and of background, also allows the adaptation to update the stories to the time that they're set in, which is today.
And makes them more dynamic.
So if this gentleman thief can be invisible, you know, it's because of the color of his skin and it's because of how white people want to see him.
Exactly.
More often than not. And he knows how to use that. But we also see the damage that that friction has created. All of which comes through quite well.
And the political tension out of which the idea of the gentleman is so fraught now. And so difficult for a character like Omar Sy to achieve, despite being naturally so. You know, Arsène Lupin, you are just naturally a gentleman. And Omar Sy's character, despite having all of those things, is not allowed that. He has to fight for that grace in
myriad
ways.
And he doesn't get it.
And he doesn't get it.
Socially.
Yeah. The other one that comes to mind, which is possibly the most brilliant film that I saw last year, was The Zone of Interest by Jonathan Glazer.
What's it adapted from?
Martin Amis's novel called The Zone of Interest, but the relation is truly just superficial. Martin Amis's novel was called The Zone of Interest and was a fictionalized telling of the relationship between Rudolf Hess, commandant of Auschwitz, and his wife and a couple of other characters. Like, it's fine. Glazer read it and got hooked to the idea of stripping the fiction away and focusing on fact. The fact being that Hess's house and Auschwitz shared a boundary wall. The fact being that Hesse's house had a beautiful garden and that its staff were inmates from Auschwitz. Zone of Interest is one of the quietest and most horrifying films I have watched. So powerful that taking everyday life and infusing it with just incredible cruelty. There's not one graphic scene, none of the usual Holocaust imagery, and yet just seeing this couple living their life, their kids, their everyday things, all against the backdrop of the Holocaust, which is just in their zone of interest. That's it. It's a masterful adaptation. It's got so little to do with the book. And it's, to me, a great example of how much you can bring out using cinema, particularly sound, which I don't think we pay enough attention to when we watch movies most of the time, because it just becomes part of the fabric of the film. In Zone of Interest, the sound is symphonic, but like in every sense, cuts into the horror of it. So the sound literally has been recreated. None of this is archival sound. And it's a reminder that the present can very, very easily be transformed into the cruelty that we thought was behind us.
This sounds like a truly literary adaptation. And I realize that the distinction I'm about to make may be false, in that here you have a filmmaker who has gotten obsessed with a novel that in some ways has a lot to do with himself and his own history, and finds a way to recast it into cinema that is very uniquely his own vision, but that is in conversation with this text. And I think the IP mode of adaptation, which is about what kind of potboiler can we bring to the screen that will hook mass audiences based on their interest in the original IP, functions on often quite different creative premises.
It does, but at the same time, at its basic, I think the point is, and Glazer's obsession is with finding a way to make the history come alive through art. And it was quite interesting that, you know, we had a set of films last year which emphasized how art is not enough to contain the horrors and the hopes of the past. You had Killers of the Flower Moon, which sort of, you know, ended with this admission of defeat. That
also
we,
IP.
Also IP.
I mean, of course, which is not to take away from Scorsese, but, you know, the story about David Gran, the writer of Killers of the Flower Moon, is that every time he's about to drop a new article for the New Yorker, networks in Hollywood get activated to try and get hold of the close to final draft way before it's actually, you know, locked for publication. And people are willing to spend quite a lot of money to see what he's doing.
It's so interesting because in Killers of the Flower Moon, not only does Scorsese really reorient what Gran had written, Gran's writing is more about the investigation and it's sort of, you know, looking at the development of the FBI, whereas Killers of the Flower Moon works as a very different story.
Right. It's about the tragedy of the Osage and,
yeah,
and about this tragic, vile love story.
Love and hate story, really. So it's a very interesting adaptation in that sense. But by the end of the film, you have this kind of admission that despite two layers of fiction, the history cannot be remembered or kept alive through art. That's what Killers of the Flower Moon ultimately seems to settle on. So, you know, go back to the history, go back to the people and remember what has been lost. Zone of Interest, on the other hand, is like art will bring things back to life. Art will make sure that the present and the past keep intersecting. It's such a beautiful and hopeful and accomplished testimony to the power of art and faith in art's ability to remind you that things are not as far away and that your present and your past are way closer than you actually think they are, if you think they aren't. The potential for commerce, of course, is guiding these adaptations, but these adaptations are turning out in their best examples to be human creativity at its cleverest.
Which is in continuity with how writers themselves adapt stories that they've heard or read themselves, which is the work of art. What I'm uncomfortable with, even as I'm doing it, is trying to draw a straight line through the demands of commerce, which I can broadly classify as IP, and the compulsions of art, which kind of are more easily contained within the idea of adaptation. But of course, these two are always mingling. They're mingling even for writers. We've seen this happen when halfway through a series, a writer very clearly is writing for cinema. Sara Ali Khan, as we are recording this, the actor Sara Ali Khan is in two different adaptations, which, you know, firmly bracket how the age of IP has affected Indian entertainment. One of them is an adaptation of an Anuja Chauhan novel, which I cannot imagine was written without one eye on the screen. Like, it 100%. Feels very clear to me that a Netflix watcher wrote that novel, and one of which was a lovely popular history of Congress Radio, which got picked up again by an OTT with money to spend.
Yeah, we're talking about Evatan, Mere Evatan. Both are regrettable examples of adaptation, unfortunately.
But they are, I think, absolutely symbolic of the age of IP that we live in.
I mean, it also begs the question that why are we in Indian entertainment not able to do a Bridgerton, for example, which is very much creativity and commerce occupying far from an equal relationship. The commerce was much higher than creativity on that one. And despite its many faux pas, it's a much more accomplished adaptation than, say, Murder Mubarak, which takes Club U to death and clubs it to death. I don't know what the answer to that is, but the fact of the matter is that we're looking for different ways to capitalize on our existing legacies. If that will mean more people reading, if that will mean more money going into the creative arts, sure. It's worrying to me that we've been talking for all of this time, and I can think of the Dunes and the Lupins and the whatever else we've talked about today. And when we come to talk about Indian adaptations, we're talking about Murder Mubarak, you know, and it's just not an example of excellence at any level.
Well, let's assume that that's down to our inadequacies rather than those of the people who entertain us.
No, it's not. But okay, fine. I'll be graceful. Or try.
On that note.
On that note, I think, on that attempted grace, and since I am clearly not capable of it, let us wind up today's chat.
No, you're the Omar Sy of this podcast. What
I
are you talking
wish.
About?
You know, my two moments when I felt like I had arrived and I don't need to arrive again. One was when Aditi Mittal made a GIF of me. You can search for Downward Spiral and find my face, which I think is like a great moment. The other is when Omar Sy liked a GIF I made.
Was it a GIF off Omar Sy?
Of course it was.
That's amazing.
But still, that'll do.
Yeah, let's get out of the studio so that I can go watch, in fact, a classic work of the age of IP, which is the Chinese drama Judge Dee's Mystery, which is dropping on Netflix as we speak, and which, by the way, is based on an 18th century Chinese detective novel about the adventures of a district magistrate. Maybe he was a county magistrate or a provincial magistrate, which was found by a Dutch translator called Robert Van Hulik in a Japanese bookstore, which Van Hulik then translated and which he then got obsessed with and started writing his own Judge Dee mysteries.
This is the show I want to watch.
And so Van Hulik's work is very popular in China. So the Judge Dee / Detective Dee mysteries have been adapted several times before, most notably in a movie by Tsui Hark, the great Tsui Hark, who got Andy Lau himself to play Judge Dee, and everyone's favorite Karina Lau to play the Empress Fu Zetian.
Okay. So, no need for any more conversation. We have to leave and watch this right away.
I mean, you have to watch the movies. Let's see how the show goes. But but from two victims of the age of IP.
Yes. To us exiting and finding hopefully triumphant examples of it. You've been listening to The Lit Pickers with Supriya and me, Dipanjana. We will be back with more conversations on books and reading. Take care.
The Lit Pickers is a Made in India production. Don't forget to rate and review and follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, tell everyone you know about the show. Share it on social media, tell your friends and family, scream about it on your rooftop. It really helps get the word out. Oh, and use the hashtag LitPickers. Follow Supriya and Dipanjana on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find all of the books they've mentioned or recommended in an online resource via a link in our episode description. Thanks. Keep listening.